name's David Griggs. I'm a Professor of Sustainable Development at both Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, and here at Warwick. So I started out doing an undergraduate degree in physics, really because I just was curious about how the world worked, and physics was seen a good way to figure that out. And then when I finished my physics degree, most of the jobs that were on offer were to find new and creative ways of killing people, in nuclear weapons and that kind of thing, the Ministry of Defence, and that didn't really sit very comfortably with me. And I had the opportunity to carry on and do a PhD in sort of atmospheric physics, which I did. So I spent 3 years working in a little cold chamber, growing ice crystals and working out how hailstones fall. And from there, moved on to the Met Office and had a number of jobs throughout the Met Office in terms of atmospheric physics and climate, and that moved me into climate, and then that moved me into climate change. I became head of the international division at the Met Office, and that got me into some of the politics around climate change. And so I then became head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Science Working Group Secretariat. So I helped to produce the third assessment report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And from there, I became director of the Hadley Centre for Climate Change in the UK, which is the UK's government research centre into climate change. So I was managing 150 climate scientists, mainly mathematicians and physicists, doing climate monitoring and climate modelling and so on. And through that period, through the awareness of the threats of climate change and the broader threats to the environment and society and so on, I figured that the job that I was in was really around telling people how terrible climate change was going to be. And if I really felt that I believed what I was saying, it's about time that I tried to actually do something about it rather than just tell people how bad it was. And I had the opportunity to go to Australia, to Melbourne, to Monash University, who asked me to go and head up a new sustainability institute. And they didn't really give me a lot of guidance, they just wanted to make a success of it. When I arrived, I was the institute, and over the 8 years that I was director, we grew the institute to be very multidisciplinary around sustainable development challenges facing the world, economic, social, environmental, with physical scientists, social scientists, economists, lawyers, psychologists, a medical doctor, all working together on trying to make the world more sustainable. And so that's really been my pathway. I stepped down as director last year so that I could do more interesting stuff than manage people, because by the time 8 years have passed, I was busy managing 40 or 50 people again. So I stepped down and I'm now just a professor in what used to be my own institute and enjoying doing research on sustainable development and sustainable development goals. I went with the big dream, but you can't just have a big dream. You need to figure out how you're going to get there. So then I had to sit down and actually develop a plan. I developed a 10-year plan of how we could make a difference. And of course, we didn't follow the plan because you never follow a plan for 10 years. But it was a useful thought process to go through to realise the components that I needed to put together to be able to do things that we needed to be able to do, and to be able to put together the different disciplines and how we wanted to do that, and what were the important issues that we wanted to work on. It really came down to something which was very, very simple in the end. Whether we worked on something really came down to three factors. The first was, is it an important problem? Because there are so many important problems in sustainable development that if it's not an important problem, why would I choose that first? Secondly, have we got the expertise to address it? Or if I haven't got the expertise, can I get it in some way? Either by bringing people in, employing them, bringing them into partner from other universities from all over the world, wherever. So can I access that expertise? And thirdly, can I get someone to pay for it? Because I can have the best idea in the world and the best people in the world, but if I can't get someone to pay for it, I can't do it. And equally, if I can get someone to pay for something and it's really important but I haven't got the expertise, I still can't do it. And equally, if I've got the money and the people but it's not important, then I still shouldn't be doing it. So really, it's quite simple. If I can put those three things together, then why wouldn't I do it? Interdisciplinarity is so important, and if there had been an undergraduate degree around like the one that's being developed here at Warwick, I would have been the first in the queue to do it, because I was curious about everything. I wasn't curious about one thing. The reason I think it's so important is because problems aren't discipline based. Problems of the real world don't fall into nice neat little boxes. Problems around poverty and hunger and climate change and health and security and social problems and what are the future jobs going to look like in a sustainable world, that they don't fall into discipline-based boxes. To be able to address those problems, you need to bring all kinds of different disciplines and thinking solve those problems. So, you know, if we need all of those things to solve the problems, why do we make it so difficult to break out of these discipline boxes? Yes, you need the deep knowledge in certain areas, and there'll always be a use and a value in having people delve deeper and deeper into their particular discipline and really understanding that at a fundamental level. But also, you need people who can come above that, take those learnings, take that fundamental knowledge, take that deep knowledge, and apply it across a whole range of different subjects, because that's the way you solve real world problems. So how much did we achieve over the period? More than was probably realistic and less than I'd hoped. Because of course you set out with that, with wanting to change the world and solve the whole thing. And, you know, at the end of 10 years we will have a sustainable society, and that was never going to be realistic. Did we do some things that made a real difference and had a really demonstrable positive impact on people and society? Yes, we did. So that is really satisfying to know that you can actually point to something and say, you know, we did that. The work we've done around water-sensitive cities, which has been implemented in a number of cities around the world, where, you know, we now use water recycling and people use grey water systems and it's all integrated and we have wetlands and so on, you know, built into cities around the world. That would not have happened without us. We could talk to all the kinds of government programs which have had our research built into them. We've had state governments in Australia adopt policies completely decarbonising their economy by 2050, which would not have happened without our analysis. The Mekong River in Vietnam is now being managed differently as a result of the work that we've done. The question of climate scepticism and views like, well, the climate's always changed, we've had hot and cold periods in the past, is a really complex one. I mean, the first one to address is the science of it. And that's a convenient thing to say, because yes, the world has always been cold and hot in the past, so it's partially true. And things that are partially true are always more plausible than things that are just downright not true. But clearly, there's clear scientific evidence that what we're seeing now is not part of a natural cycle. If you look at the natural cycle, we've got climate records through proxy, what we call proxy records, looking at ice cores and things like that, going back 700,000 years, longer than that. And the climate changes through what we call glacial and interglacial periods. Glacial periods when the Earth is very cold, and interglacial periods when it's warm, and we're currently in an interglacial period. And those cycles happen on a fairly regular basis over hundreds of thousands of years. And we know what's caused them. It causes by the way that the Earth recesses around the Sun. It's called the Milankovitch cycle. So that's all understood. The changes that we're seeing over the last 100 years have taken the Earth way, way outside that natural cycle. Way outside. It can't possibly be part of that natural cycle that we're seeing. So there has to be another cause. And we're confident we know what that cause is, which is the human emissions of greenhouse gases and climate change and the greenhouse effect, whatever you want to call it. So just because there is a plausible half-truth, just because some climate change is natural, doesn't mean all climate change is natural. And this climate change we're seeing now is not natural. And no amount of trying to convince yourself that it is going to avoid the truth, which is that it is man-made. When people say they don't believe in climate change, I say, well, do you believe in gravity? You can choose not to believe in gravity, but the apple still falls and hits you on the head, whether you believe in gravity or not. Whether you believe in climate change or not, the Earth is still going to get hotter. The question then is, why do people cling to these beliefs about climate scepticism when the weight of evidence is so overwhelming? People make decisions on tiny little margins of proof all the time. Why, when there's this massive, overwhelming evidence of proof on climate change, do people still find ways to deny it? And that comes down to things that are very deep-rooted in us as human beings. And that becomes much more into the psychology of us as human beings. So I'll give a couple of examples. One, as human beings, we are fundamentally wired. Our brains are wired to respond to immediate threats. So if I walked up to you in the street with a crowbar and went to hit you over the head, the chances are you wouldn't just sort of stand and think, I think I'll wait and see what happens here and see whether something bad is going to happen. You would immediately react. Your endorphins, adrenaline starts pumping, you either fight or flight. You know, can I fight this person off? Can I run? Immediate reaction. That triggers all the things in your brain which says this is a threat. Climate change doesn't do that. Scientifically, technically, intellectually, you know it's a problem. You know it's a terrible problem. But when you go home tonight, what's different? Does it feel different? Does it look different? Does it smell different? Nothing's changed. So your brain tells you that this isn't a problem, because it's a problem in another time and place. And so those kinds of intellectual problems we as human beings are not good at. You know, we're good at responding to crises. We're not good at responding to things where you have to plan for the longer term. And so that's why people try, you know, say there's another climate crisis, to try and generate, to try and trigger these emotional responses. So if it doesn't trigger that emotional response, it makes it very difficult. The second thing is what we call cognitive dissonance. We like to have in ourselves what we believe and how we behave to be in line. And if that's not the case, then we feel uncomfortable. So if we believe in climate change and we do something about it, then we're happy. Because we believe in something, we're doing something about it, we're cognitively aligned. If we believe in climate change and don't do something about it, there's a dissonance there. I know there's a problem and I'm not doing anything about it. And you start to feel guilty, you start to feel anxious, you start to feel uncomfortable. And nobody likes to live their lives living with anxiety and discomfort and so on. So you then have two choices. You can start doing something about it, in which case you believe in it and you are doing something about it and you're back in line and everything's harmonious again. But doing something about it is actually quite difficult. You have to change what you're doing. And your other choice is to stop believing in it. Because if I don't believe in it, I'm not doing anything, then again, I'm back in line again. So when you have all of these vested interests and all of these lobby groups telling you that climate change isn't a problem and not to believe in, then your brain is saying, that's really what I want to hear. Well, if I just put off making a decision here, and you know, there's all this uncertainty, and when it's all sorted, then I'll start to do something, but until then, I'll wait and see. Then suddenly you feel fine again. So even though kind of in the back of your mind, you know that that's a bit of a cop-out, it's enough to be able to convince yourself that you can get rid of this cognitive dissonance. So why people don't believe in climate change is more to do with psychology and worldview and how they see the world than it is about the science, because the science is settled. Can we create a sustainable future is a question I ask myself almost on a daily basis. And the answer depends on how I feel that morning when I get out of bed, I guess. So I feel fairly schizophrenic about it. There are days when, you know, if I'm having a bad day, I think the challenges are so enormous. The progress that we're making is so slow. You know, the forces of evil that aligned against us are so strong. The vested interests are so powerful that we simply will not be able to achieve what we need to achieve in the very short time that we have to achieve it. On my good days, I look at things like the Sustainable Development Goals, which have 17 goals, 169 targets. Every single one of those targets is easily achievable. We don't need to invent anything. We have the technology, we have the knowledge, we have the money, we have the people, we have everything we need to achieve those. All we need is a bit of political will and public support and people to get off their backsides and do it. And it would be easy. We can easily create a sustainable and thriving society. We can solve climate change. We don't need to invent any new technology. All it needs is decisions to be made to do it. Sometimes it surprises me how easy it actually would be to do. On a global sense, it probably wouldn't even cost us anything. You know, we would actually have a stronger, more thriving society if we did it. But creating change is difficult. The question I think I'm most often asked is, what can I do to make a difference? You know, there are 7 billion people on the planet, 7.3 now. I'm one person, what possible difference can I make? And it's the most difficult question to answer because everybody's different. And the only answer you can give is, well, everybody should do what they can do. Because what everybody can do is different. What I can do as someone who has access to politicians and has access to scientific journals and so on, is different to what someone else can do. But everybody can do something. And that's the tragedy of climate change and sustainable development, is that, you know, there's no magic silver bullet. You know, you can't just do one thing. You know, it's not like the ozone hole where if we just get rid of CFCs, it'll all be fixed. Climate change doesn't work that way. Everything we do, every time you switch a light on, every time you eat a piece of steak, every time you get in a car, every time you do anything, you are contributing to the problem or you're part of the solution. So everybody needs to do what they can do in their personal life, in the choices that they make, you know, around which appliances they buy, what food they eat, how they get to work, all of those things in their working life, about the jobs that they take and the jobs that they do and how they do them and how they influence the people at work and how they do they form green teams within their workplace to make, you know, to recycle, to double-sided print on their papers, and all of that kind of thing, through the role that they can play in broader society in terms of how they exercise their political choices, how they can become politically active, and so on. And not everything you do will be the right decision, because I hear people, you know, there's paralysis by analysis. I don't know whether it's better to eat this or that, or I don't know whether it's better to buy this one or that one. Well, don't get angst about it, because if you try and make the right decision every time, you'll get it right 90% of the time. You know, don't beat yourself up about the 10% that you get wrong, because at least you're trying to do the right thing. Not everything you do will have an impact. You know, I'm sure 99% of the things that I do have no impact whatsoever. But you keep doing them because you don't know which is the 1% of the things you'll do which really do have an impact. I'll give you one example. In Australia, there was a debate around whether the carbon tax should be introduced. And I'm friendly with one of the people who were in the cabinet at the time. And they had announced that they were going to delay the introduction of a carbon tax. And this person, who was a member of the cabinet, got a letter from his constituent, who was a vicar. And this vicar said, "You need to know that I'm a staunch supporter of your party. I've always voted for you. I always will. I will never vote for the other one. But you need to know that I'm really, really, really angry about this. Do you realise what you're doing for future generations? Do you realise, you know, how ethically and morally bankrupt this decision is?" And so on and so on and so on. It was just a complete rant. And that had such an impact on that member of parliament. He took that into the cabinet room for the next cabinet meeting, put it on the table and said, "Read this. If we are alienating our core supporters, we are moving away from our core values and principles, and we can't do that." And they reversed the decision. That vicar will never know the impact his letter had, but he took the trouble to write it. He may write 1,000 letters, and none of them will have had any impact, but that one did. And so if everybody writes a letter, maybe one of them will have an impact. Or maybe if everybody writes a letter, then suddenly you've got 1,000, 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 letters, and that will have an impact. So the simple answer to a very difficult question is everybody does what everybody can do. So what would happen, what would sort of best and worst case scenario is if we either do or don't implement the Sustainable Development Goals? The worst case scenario is that the world continues to emit large quantities of greenhouse gases, that we continue to have growing social and economic inequality, that we continue to have a more divided society, both within countries and between countries, that we continue to have ever-increasing economic crises, because the economic system is now out beyond the control of any individual or government to control it, as was shown within the GFC. Some people have postulated that we are reaching, most societies go through a phase of growth, prosperity, and then collapse. That there is the potential for our current global society to collapse completely. Even if that doesn't happen, the consequences of things like climate change, extreme heat, floods, droughts, food shortages around the world, for price increases. I really don't want to think about that world. I really don't want to think about that world. I'd much rather think about the world where we implement the Sustainable Development Goals. The Sustainable Development Goals aren't perfect. A political compromise created in New York between ambassadors. But if you look at the targets, 169 of them, and yes, there are too many and so on. But if we achieve those things, the world would be a better place. It would be a fairer place. It would be a juster place. It would be a place where human beings and flora and fauna could continue to survive and thrive on the planet. It wouldn't be a perfect place, it wouldn't be nirvana, but it would be a much nicer place for far more people on this planet than it currently is today. And just as an aside, people who criticise the Sustainable Development Goals for the fact that they are a political compromise and there are, they say, 17 goals and 169 targets and there are too many and they're not comprehensive and they're not the best ones that they could possibly be and all of those things. And all of those things are true. But the fact that we have got all of the world's governments to agree on an agenda of 17 goals and 169 targets to try and create a sustainable future is an incredible achievement. Trying to get 200 countries to agree what to have for breakfast is an incredible achievement, never mind getting them to agree on sustainable development goals. The sustainable development goals are what they are. just get over it, let's get on, let's implement them, and let's make the world a better place.
This podcast was recorded and edited by Andy Milnita.